Tamaria, welcome to First Up to Tahi ki te oho for Rahina. That's Monday. Today's the 15th of April. Ko Nathan Rarere aho. Coming up, we cross to Alex Carrier in Israel in the wake of Iran's retaliatory attack. We also have the reaction from Mitch in the USA and Nita in Europe. Correspondent Pam Corkery is in Australia. She's got the details on Saturday's horrible knife attack there in Bondi Junction. And we hear how people feel about public transport subsidies ending next month.
It's like $5 either way, which sounds fine until you realise you're spending $10 a day and then you're spending that 5 days a week, and then you try to argue that you're saving money by not getting fuel for a car or anything, but it feels like I'm spending an awful lot on it.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to First Up to Tahi ki te oho as we rip back into it here this week. Lots of news to get to in the world. We'll head to Tel Aviv later this hour to speak to Alex Carrier, our reporter who is there right now in Israel. We begin in the USA this morning, though. News Hub's Mitch McCann has been monitoring reactions stateside to all of this with this attack there. He joins us now from New York City. Morena, Mitch. Hey, and what has the reaction been from the White House to Iran's attacks on Israel?
Yeah, good morning, Nathan. Well, the White House has reacted strongly to this. Joe Biden has put out a statement in the last few hours saying he condemns these attacks in the strongest possible terms. As you heard in the news last night, Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel, and it came after airstrikes on the Iranian embassy in Syria earlier this month. So this was a retaliation for that attack, and it's being called the first direct attack on Israel after years of a shadow war between the two countries. The good news for Israel, if there is any, is that nearly all of those drones were shot down with the help of the US last night, and the ones that did land only caused minor damage. Now, Joe Biden has convened a meeting of the G7, that's the group of seven leaders today. Now, I've just seen some photos come up online in the last few moments of those G7 leaders sitting at a computer on a Zoom screen talking to each other. So they're mulling over what's happened this morning. And then the United Nations Security Council here in New York is going to hold an emergency meeting at around 4 o'clock this afternoon, which is around 8 o'clock in the morning back home in New Zealand. Now, it might sound surprising, given they've just fired 300 drones at Israel, but Iran says it's not interested in a wider full-scale war and that the retaliation is now over. Iran's foreign minister says at this point, the Islamic Republic of Iran has no intention of continuing defensive operations. And here's the important part, though. But if necessary, Iran will not hesitate to protect its legitimate interests against any new aggression. So Iran essentially saying there, it's over for now, but don't push us any further. And the focus moving forward, as I say, in the next couple of hours is to see what came out of that G7 meeting we've just seen this morning, what action the United Nations will take. And the White House says that every decision, every discussion that the president has had is designed to not let this become a broad regional war. And that's where his head is at the moment. So very an unfolding situation, NATO, still in the Middle East.
Yeah, indeed. Everyone in the world looking at that one. Let's move to something nearer to you. The former president, Donald Trump, his historic criminal trial begins on Monday with jury selection. And it could be quite hard finding an impartial jury, I understand.
Yeah, it could be very hard, especially here in New York. So this is going to be an historic day tomorrow in the history of the United States. Donald Trump becomes the first former president to face a criminal trial when he heads to court in Manhattan. Now, this is the first of four criminal trials, as we know. It's possibly the only one he'll face now before this November's election. He's pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records when trying to cover up payments to an adult film star to keep the affair quiet. And as you mentioned, the first thing we're going to see in this trial is something very standard. That is the jury selection. And it won't be an easy thing. The judge has to find 12 New Yorkers whose personal and political opinions will not impact their decision-making in this case. And it's quite hard here at times to find anyone that doesn't have an opinion anyway on Donald Trump. So that selection could take at least a week, possibly 2 weeks, before they even have a jury. I saw a form that the judge is making the jurors or the potential jurors fill out, asking them everything from whether or not they've been to a Donald Trump rally before to watch which news media they consume. And you have to tick boxes of things like CNN, Fox News, and they're going to make up their mind that way. And it comes as Donald Trump obviously plans to win back the White House in November. This trial will actually require him to be in court for up to 4 days a week for 2 months of this trial. So it's a critical time for him to be campaigning, and one that probably Joe Biden is going to take advantage of.
You mentioned the campaign. A lot of pressure coming on both Trump and Biden camps to commit those to presidential debates later in the year. Why do you think they haven't locked them in?
Yeah, well, I think Joe Biden is the one that is unsure whether they should be happening at the moment. What's happened this morning is that 12 US news companies, they've put out this open letter asking Joe Biden and Donald Trump to agree to presidential TV debates ahead of the election. Now, these have been held since way back in 1960. Kennedy and Nixon, I think, was the first one. Donald Trump has said, Nathan, that he's willing to go head-to-head with Joe Biden anytime, any place, anywhere, starting now. But Joe Biden is a bit uncommitted, saying that it depends on Donald Trump's behaviour. The open letter from the news network says it's exceptionally high stakes. There is simply no substitute for the candidates debating each other before the American people, their visions for the future of our nation. And just finally, you probably remember back in 2020 what an absolute debacle some of those debates were. So I think from a spectator's point of view, I think a lot of Americans would like to see those debates happen. I'm just not sure if it's a great thing for democracy to see two men sort of fighting it out on the stage, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I was just thinking there, it's a great and lofty statement to say no substitute for candidates debating each other, just as long as they are actually just debating each other. And that's probably the real problem with getting that one done. Mitch McCann, thank you so much for your time from New York City. That is Mitch News Hub's Mitch McCann. It's 11 and a half past five. That was over there, and then of course we saw these reports on the weekend, just horrific. Six people killed and several badly injured in a stabbing attack at a shopping centre in Bondi Junction, Sydney on Saturday. The male attacker eventually shot dead by a police officer. Our Australia correspondent Pam Corkery is with us with details. Pam, just I know it would have sent obviously shock waves everywhere. What do we know about the attacker and any sort of motive?
Well, I'll tell you how the whole thing unfolded, and we'll go in that order.
Right.
So this 40-year-old Joel Couchy, he left a curry joint just before 3 p.m. on Saturday, then straight to nearby Westfield Plaza and Bondi Junction about 10 past 3. He walked into the shopping centre. He was wearing a Kangaroos rugby league jersey. They'll enjoy that. And brandishing what is reckoned to be about a 30-centimetre hunting knife. The attack lasted about 25 minutes, killing, as you said, six people, injuring 12 others, including a nine-month-old baby, the daughter of the deceased. Now, a lone female police officer, she's a high-ranking inspector, she ran towards the man, told him to drop the knife. He refused to. He was brandishing it around. She shot him in the chest. So, you know, police said there's no evidence the attack was terrorism-related. It appears to be linked to his mental health. He arrived, actually, he's been living in Queensland, not far from me, in Brisbane. Mm. And he arrived in New South Wales only a month ago. And police have confirmed that a gender-based attack was being considered, given that five out of the six dead are women.
Now, you mentioned there before mental health. So he was not known to police through, what, threats that he'd made or behaviour prior?
No, he hadn't made it, just he was difficult. Because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 17 and had many complex mental health issues, you know, and police and health authorities knew that. But he had never been charged with anything in Queensland.
No. What do we know about the victims, Pam?
Well, let's see. I'll run through them. Ashley Good, that's whose nine-month-old daughter is in intensive care with stab wounds, her first child. She's 38. Dawn Singleton, 25, the 25-year-old daughter of businessman John Singleton. He's probably the best-known business person in Australia and horse racing aficionado. Faraz Tahir, a 30-year-old Pakistani national who had come here a year ago, who was working as a security guard. He's the sole male among the dead. Mm. Jade Young, a stalwart of the Bronte Surf Life Saving Club, and Pakria Darchia, 51. She's an artist designer who studied business administration and could speak three languages. And another woman who was still unnamed. Sorry to drag that out, and it'll mean nothing probably, but you want to say their names.
Yeah.
It's Yeah, you know, it's just been dreadful.
No, I think it does mean something to say their names. I mean, they deserve that. What's the response been around Australia?
Look, an amazing sort of togetherness. There's sincere mourning. Like, and everyone needed connection. Like, I took heaps of phone calls yesterday from people I don't even like, you know, who said, well, have you heard it? And we were talking. It's obvious, you know, that around the country this is happening. The areas outside Bondi Junction, you know, other cities have been, you know, swamped with flowers. There's been unplanned vigils that happened overnight, and flags that have been flown at half mast on all government buildings today. I think this has been a real kick in the guts. It's the biggest sort of mass shooting since there was the chocolate lint murders in Sydney about that was 10 years ago. Yeah. And everyone, I think, is going, God, I was worried about this, I was worried about this. But nothing's as important as these people who have been killed or are maimed. The parents, by the way, of the killer, they've just denounced him. He's been on the run, or he left home when he was about 20. They haven't denounced him, but they've just apologised in the saddest possible way, saying, you know, he was just affected by his mental health and he behaved badly, you know.
Yeah, tragic all around. Pam, thank you very much for your time. Pam Corkery there with our report there from Australia. Half past five here on Monday morning at First Up to Tahi Kitioho on RNZ National with me, Nathan Rarere. We go to Europe now. Let's get a reaction to the escalation happening in the Middle East there with our correspondent in Germany, Nita Blake-Person. Morena, Nita.
Kia ora, Nathan. How are you?
I'm good. Tell us what the reaction's been from the European leaders.
Some pretty widespread and swift condemnation right across the board, really. A lot of leaders from right across the European Union have come out strongly and quickly saying this has got to stop. Iran and its proxies must immediately cease these attacks, calling them a major escalation. EU Parliament has said the EU is going to keep working to de-escalate and stop the situation spiralling into more bloodshed. So, yeah, some really strong language and firm condemnation. Emmanuel Macron from France has said, you know, this continues to threaten to destabilise the whole region. And it was French military forces along with Britain and America that helped Israel in defending from these Iran attacks last night. So, you know, even EU member states that typically go against Brussels, the Belgium, you know, the EU line, they've joined this criticism. Hungary's far-right leader, Viktor Orban, is also saying, you know, he's hoping for the safety of the Israeli people.
Okay. Just not connected to this, but still the same area. Why has Germany offered a cash payment, a one-off cash payment here to Holocaust survivors from Israel?
I guess there is a vague connection here. So this is Germany making a payment to Holocaust survivors living in Israel to help them cope with the impacts of the October 7th attacks. It works out to be about €220 each for the 113,000 Holocaust survivors living in Israel, about 25 million all up. And the German finance ministry has said many Holocaust survivors were hard hit by those Hamas attacks on October 7th, whether it was the loss of their homes, support systems, or other forms of care. And it's been a stressful situation, exacerbated by anti-Semitism, which has been expressed around the world. So this is intended as a gesture of solidarity and support from Germany to Israel. You know, we have heard repeatedly from German politicians that they stand with Israel, that Israel's security is Germany's reason for being, all a reference to Germany's relationship with Israel due to the Holocaust. But there is growing concern in parts of Germany about the way Israel is carrying out its military offensive. So while there is at a political level this absolute alliance and support, I would say there's, you know, growing concern. There's court cases and continue to be a lot of protests and tension over Israel's offensive, which, you know, it's killed more than 33,000 people now.
Yeah. I see there Germany, we'll keep it with German politics, have approved a gender identity law. So what does this mean for trans, intersex and non-binary Germans?
Well, supposedly it means it's going to be a smoother and an easier process for people who want to change their name and their gender identity, because under the current law, people have to be assessed by two psychiatrists and a court has to have given permission before those changes are being made. So this new legislation, the Self-Determination Act, is going to allow these changes to be made in a simpler procedure. It's Germany, so there is still some bureaucracy there. They can't quite get rid of that. The law requires people to inform registry officers 3 months in advance of the changes to be made, but overall a lot simpler process. The legislation does allow operators of facilities like gyms or changing rooms for women to continue to decide who has access to them. So that has been put in there. And while the law has passed, it's come under a lot of fire from some politicians, perhaps predictably those from the far right or more conservative politicians. They've said it will allow people to arbitrarily change their genders, but also public support for the bill has actually been quite split. There was a poll last year that found 46% of respondents were in favour, but 41% were against. So while it has passed, there has been some reservations from the community on this one.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time. A report out of Germany there with Nita Blake-Person. 21, now and a half past five here at First Up on RNZ National. Coming up, late winners, extra time letdowns, and the Blues lifting a trophy. What's all that about? We'll talk weekend sport with Joe Porter very soon. And also public transport users are bracing for big fare hikes when the government subsidy ends. Leonard Powell investigates.
There they are standing in the rear. Big ones, small ones, some as big as your head.
Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, fresh out of the box. It's the Minister of Fruit and Veg, it's Glenn Forsyth. Actually, no, he's sitting under a spray mister. Hey, that's where you'd be, the Minister of Fruit and Veggies.
Marina, sir, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Not only crunching apples, but you are also crunching numbers, Glenn. What has Stats NZ got to say about the price of fresh produce?
Oh, wow. Stats New Zealand has come up with some terrific news for fruit and vegetables. A 13.3 decrease in costs for year ending March 2024. Now, this is significant considering other categories had increases like restaurant meals, takeaways, grocery foods and non-alcoholic beverages. Now, often in winter, fresh produce gets a bad rap, but right now, and has been for the case some time, many lines are in abundance of supply. So take advantage of this, and even more so during school holidays when demand falls flat and build up our immune systems coming into winter. What is on the vegetable menu at the Rotary household currently, and have you been noticing some of these great prices?
A lot of broccoli just at the moment. We're in a real broccoli phase.
Broccoli, fantastic. Yeah. A lot of outlets named that, you know, when the superfood groups came out, named that as number one. So not only crops that can come to bad weather are in good supply, such as baby spinach, spring onions, celery, leeks and Brussels sprouts, they're all there. And our root crop growers, with the help of the weather being on our side late last year, we remember, and into 2024, we are going to have better supply through our colder months this year compared to 2023 of carrots, onions, potatoes and kumara as well. So for all of us struggling with the cost of living crisis, this is a welcomed gift. We just can't get over it. We're so happy as an industry that there's so many good, you know, items out there right now.
Beautiful. Well, tell us, go into veggies further. What's happening?
Veggies. We're approaching M for May, which brings us Mother's Day and more mushrooms, but vegetables.co.nz for April highlight many other veggies in great supply. Some include garlic, shallots, turnip, fennel, celeriac, parsnip and pumpkin. So, you know, it's quite a good floor down here this morning also of tomatoes. Now, garlic's been cultivated in Central Asia for thousands of years, and most garlic bulbs contain 10 cloves. We grow most of our garlic in Marlborough and Canterbury, but, you know, best to buy in small amounts, keeping in a cool, dry place away from sunlight and breaking off those cloves when you need them. Turnips have been popular since Roman times, and smaller young turnips have a more tender and delicate peppery taste, so you could try raw in salads or grated and cooked in stews or sliced into stir fries. Now, we also had a question on Friday to address on New Zealand garlic cost compared to imported garlic, Nathan.
Yes, and why is the New Zealand garlic often more expensive than the imported stuff?
Well, okay, so firstly, it is a lot more expensive for us to grow. And in the USA, there is a 100% tariff on Chinese garlic. We don't have that here. However, the key thing for us is that while imports are lower, our garlic is around three times as flavoursome, which means it goes further. It also has naturally higher Brix, so it has a cleaner, sweeter taste. We think its flavour is enhanced by our clean air, water and soil, so it does come down to choice. And on the garlic.co.nz website, there is a great garlic shallot combo on there you can buy, among other stuff. Yeah, it's a good website if you want to buy direct and buy a bit more.
Yeah, why not? What about fruit?
Oh, fruit. Here comes the gold like Johnny Walker down the home straight. Gold kiwi fruit is pouring in the doors. Or if you like your vitamin C citrus style, New Zealand satsumas are here from Northland, and so are good numbers still of USA oranges. There are still plenty of seedless grapes from Australia or Chile, and New Zealand is producing plenty of limes, feijoas, Wintonellis pears and apples. Some newer ones featuring now are Mareri Red, which is a high-coloured Braeburn, the Lemonade, that's a yellow apple, Jazz and New Zealand Rose are here now. Now, are you ready for your early Monday pop quiz, Nathan? It's sport related.
Okay, go. Okay. I don't know why. I just closed my eyes. Apparently, it's going to make it easier to answer. Okay, close my eyes. Okay, go.
Okay, go. Okay. Do you know who Rene Holmes is?
Rene Holmes. Not the fullback. No?
Rugby star.
Oh, yeah. The fullback. Yes.
Yes, you're awesome, mate. So this amazing Kiwi rugby star has partnered with Gisborne-based produce company First Fresh and be their first ever brand ambassador for 2 years. So their key goals are to highlight when fruit is available, how best to eat and prepare them, and generally showcase the benefits of Gisborne-grown citrus and persimmons to a wide audience. Yeah. Marketing manager Grant Walsh caught up with him last week. He adds that Rene's values and theirs align, and the Gisborne connections are very strong through relationships and whānau. They are proud of her and what she's doing, and she's proud of her Gisborne roots and connection to First Fresh. So that is amazing. First Fresh are harvesting limes and Meyer lemons now, and mandarins and persimmons from the end of this month. So go, Rene. Thank you very much.
Yeah, fantastic.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Watching Rene play on Saturday afternoon, and when I see Rene Holmes, I thought, not the fullback, because he said it was a Gisborne star, and I thought, oh, it's got to be one of those surf athletes. So I had surf athlete in my head. Anyway, it's April the 15th. Happy birthday to a lot of famous people. One of whom, she was a songwriter who wrote so many songs for other people, eventually sang one of her own songs. And it went pretty well. Linda Perry here when she was singing with Four Non-Blondes and not writing songs for people like Pink or everybody else. Other birthdays coming out today. Emma Watson is 34. Seth Rogen is 42. Ed O'Brien from Radiohead, he's very tall, also at 56. And Emma Thompson, 65 years old today. Good day to be a British actress called Emma. It's just a tune, this one. Quite a big day for tragedy this day. In 1912, at 2:20 a.m., the unsinkable Titanic sinks, killing, it depends on whose report you get, the British one or the American report. So around 1,500 people there died on board that. And also on this day, 1989, the Hillsborough Football Stadium disaster. 96 people killed in a crush, 766 others injured during the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. On this day in 1999, the body of Tammy Wynette was exhumed from her grave in an attempt to settle a dispute over how the country music legend died. A new autopsy was conducted on her a week after her daughters filed a wrongful death lawsuit against her doctor and her husband and manager, George Ritchie, claiming that they were responsible for the death 12 months ago. Ritchie said he had requested the autopsy because of the allegations made against him, and it was indeed found that she had died for health reasons. And also in tragedy, this day in 2013, near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, those two bombs went off there. Three people killed, 260 wounded in the terrorist attack. And in 2019, the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris caught fire during the restoration campaign. There were some firsts on this day. In 1923, insulin became available for people with diabetes. On this day in 1947, baseball player Jackie Robinson broke the baseball racial barrier, played his first major league game for the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field. He wore number 42, which is why tomorrow, which will be the 15th over there, every single player in Major League Baseball wears number 42 tomorrow. On this day in 1955, Ray Kroc opened the first of his McDonald's franchises. That went okay. His first day sales, $366.12. They're a bit more profitable now. The TV show that I loved, In Living Colour, premiered on Fox TV on this day in 1990. And in 2004 in New Zealand, they found him, Shrek the Sheep, who had successfully evaded muster for 6 years, discovered in a cave on this day in Otago after growing 27 kilos worth of fleece. He did well to avoid all those. And those are the happenings of April the 15th. Cash rules everything around me. Queen, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Anand Zaki is with me now from the business team. Good to hear your voice, sir.
Kia ora, yeah, good to be back. How are you?
I'm good. Now, a really good way if someone's getting good at making things is ban them, right? Is that one thing, or is this is entirely, that's just me guessing wildly and I shouldn't speculate. I'll just read the lead in properly. Could the US ban China-made electric vehicles?
Yeah, well, when I saw this, I thought, hang on, could it really happen? But a very senior US politician is actually calling for this. The chair of the US Senate Banking Committee, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown, is calling on President Biden to ban the imports of Chinese-made EVs into the US. And he says Chinese electric vehicles are an existential threat to the American auto industry. Now, worth mentioning, he is from the state of Ohio, which is a car-producing state, and it is an election year. But nonetheless, they appear to be the strongest comments yet by any US elected official on the issue. Others want steep tariffs to keep Chinese EVs out of the country. And a couple of months ago, the White House said there will be an investigation into whether Chinese cars pose a national security risk. So very strong comments. And with the recent stuff with TikTok, you know, you wouldn't really put it past the Americans to do something like this, I suppose. So, I suppose could potentially be on the cards.
Right. So a Build Your Dreams SUV could cause a threat to the existence of a person, group, society, or even humanity as a whole. Okay. sure. Let's go to the next one. Weaker inflation numbers could come out this week then.
Yeah, big week as far as economic numbers are concerned in New Zealand. We've got the latest inflation data from Stats NZ out on Wednesday, and it'll show inflation numbers for the first 3 months of the year. And expectations are that it'll fall to about 4%, 4.2%, that sort of range. It was at 4.7% in the final quarter of last year. But the key thing is that the forecasts are all above the Reserve Bank's expectations of 3.8%, and the Reserve Bank sets the official cash rate. So why are the retail banks expecting inflation to be stronger than the RBNZ's forecast? Well, the key to that is sticky domestic prices are continuing to come in stronger than expectations. Things like insurance costs are likely to pose a challenge to the Reserve Bank. If you have insurance, you will know firsthand what I'm talking about. Those premiums have skyrocketed for a lot of people, and imported inflation, while it is falling, is likely to come in stronger than expectations as well. So all in all, reinforcing beliefs that rates will stay on hold for the time being.
All right, thank you very much. You can hear more from Anand and the business team on Morning Report this morning at 10:27. Let's go see what's happening in the money market now. Your Kiwi dollar is worth 59.36 US cents, 91.79 Australian cents, 47.67 British pence, 55.77 Euro cents, 90.99 Japanese yen, and 4.29 yuan. Sports reporter Joe Porter with me right now. What a weekend, Joe. What a weekend. And it's still going.
Yeah, Ryan Fox is still going at the Masters, and there's plenty that has happened overnight. And, of course, Arsenal have just been beaten 2-0 by Aston Villa to miss out on their chance to go back to the top of the Premier League. Man City, not another title, surely. Gosh. Anyway, Liverpool also lost.
Oh, did they? Oh, boy, with this, so much happening here. Update me on Ryan Fox, because like everyone else, I was all about the Masters for the first half of Friday.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I was like, oh, stupid Dunn is still fixed against New Zealand.
Yeah, no, well, he's doing all right. He's in his final round. He's tied for about 20th at the moment. He's having a good day. I think he was 2 or 3 under par for the day, which makes him 2 over-ish for the tournament. And he's still, you know, a fair way off 7 under Scottie Scheffler, who hasn't started his round yet. So early days for the Masters final round. Ryan Fox doing his best to have a good final showing, but it doesn't look like he's going to trouble the leaders, but you never know. You never know.
I mean, call me John Key, but I got really annoyed scrolling through because they get all excited going, he's improved. Oh, that's Australian flag. He's improved. Oh, it's those little flags. We need a different sports thing. Anyway, actually, let's go to Glory first. How about them Blues, them Blues and the Opiki?
Yeah, what a
That was a good fight back.
Oh, it was, wasn't it? And it was great to see them do it at home. And the Blues have been the most consistent team all year, so well-deserved. And, yeah, what, were they down 18-5 with 15 to go? Mm. Something like that. And, yeah, so to come back from there shows a lot of mental fortitude, and they did it with style. So well done, the Blues, their first Opiki title, well-deserved. Yeah, it was a cracking game of rugby.
It was. I'm going to say, I think they need Caitlin Vinicola in the Ferns. Just saying. Where should we go to? And another, actually, good work there, really late by the Phoenix as well, to hang in here.
Yeah, and just, you know, grab a late winner and do what they needed to do to stay right in the race for that minor premiership. Obviously, Central Coast won as well, so the Phoenix stay second level on points with them, but slightly behind on goal difference. So, man, was there two rounds remaining now? So it absolutely comes down to the wire, that minor premiership race, and how good would it be for the Phoenix to get up. And they're doing all they can to ensure that happens, so good on them. Go those good fighting men of the Wellington Phoenix.
Now, as I was trying to squish absolutely everything, I squished everything in all week. I'm telling you, Joe, I'm telling you. I got all my chores done early on the Sunday morning.
Well,
by the way, I did the best. You know that pressure? There's two pressures I passed on the weekend, man pressures. One was the reversing the trailer in at the refuse station in one go, and the other one was returning it there at the Shell station in front of everyone. So, but I got all those done so I could get back and watch it. I'm talking netball here. I don't think I've seen a sin bin, and I don't think I've seen a sin bin for each team in the same game. That Mystics Magic game, that was the first.
Yeah, well, fiery start, I suppose, and, you know, the Mystics out to defend their title, but I don't think I've seen that before in netball. I can't remember the last time I saw a Sindrin, let alone two in a game. So
someone will know. 2-0-1, let us know.
Bridget will definitely know. I'll ask Bridget her. I'll consult our netball oracle, Bridget Tunnicliffe, when she gets into the office, because she'll have all the details and the gossip around that one.
Mm. And don't touch Sean Johnson's leg, apparently.
Yeah, no, don't touch. That was another dramatic match. Golden Point couldn't decide it. A draw is a very rare occurrence in the NRL, isn't it? So, but again, you know, a very tough match. Look, you can't touch Sean Johnson's leg. A bit of controversy around that call, but the Warriors, they live to fight another day. They stay well and truly in the race there, and well and truly with some good momentum. So, you know, it's those little games where in the past the Warriors would have lost those, you know?
Mm.
So it's to see them at least snatching a draw is bodes well, I believe, for later in the year.
Love a good boding. Still some netball to go today, so we'll have that as well. And Joe and the team will keep you abreast of what is happening in the Masters as well. Thank you very much, Joe. There is Joe Porter, sports reporter. It is 18 and a half to 6. Nathan Rarere here at First Up. Between now and the end of the program, we will be talking to our First Up correspondent, Alex Cartier, who will be with you from Tel Aviv. Also, our reporter Leonard Powell went out to the bus stop to find out what people will pay when the government-funded fare subsidy ends. The professionals of the RNZ Chip are here after 6 to tell us what's happening on Morning Report. It's Corin Dan. Kia ora.
Atamaria, good morning, Nathan. Good morning, everyone. Two big stories to cover this morning, obviously. First in the Middle East with escalating tensions there following Iran's drone and missile strike on Israel. The Israeli Defence Force has just given a press conference. There's no signal or sign yet whether there will be a retaliation or not. Certainly the US seems to be encouraging Israel not to do that. That will have big consequences, obviously. So we will be covering that extensively this morning and getting the very latest. Australia too, obviously horrific events over the weekends with this mall stabbing. I've spoken to a ABC correspondent for the very latest too on that and how the people of Sydney are faring. It is quite a shock for people in Sydney, as you can imagine. We will also look in on gang issues in Hastings, and we'll talk to the police association too about the events on Saturday night where a Waikato police officer ended up stuck in a fleeing vehicle with an offender.
Yes,
it was a pretty extraordinary story. As well, so quite a bit to cover there, and I'm sure we'll cover some sport and you know,
just everything. And we'll get it all. Well, I mean, they should have won.
Warriors were good. The Crusaders were terrible. The Hurricanes were good.
Is that good?
Yeah. Ryan Fox is slipping.
I mean, let's go Hurricanes. Won the whole weekend. Everyone knows that.
They did, really.
Everyone agrees. Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time. There is Corin Dan and, of course, Morning Report with you after 6. Iran launched explosive drones and fired missiles at Israel yesterday in its first direct attack on Israeli territory. The attack was reported to be a retaliation for Israel's strike on Iran's consulate in Damascus. Our correspondent, Alex Cartier, is with us now in the war zone, joins us now. Alex, thank you very much for being here. What are the latest details you can give us on this attack?
Atamaria, well, it was an enormous attack. It was a vast scale. You're looking at 185 explosive drones, 36 cruise missiles, and perhaps the eyebrow raiser, 110 ballistic missiles. These are very, very powerful weapons that certainly would have been a surprise to the Israelis. But to give you a sense of quite how successful the air defenses and that coalition of countries were in shooting these missiles down, 185 drones, 36 cruise missiles, 110 ballistic missiles, only 7 of those ballistic missiles made it through, mostly targeting the airbase from which the strike, which hit the building adjacent to the consulate in Damascus, which started this retaliation, the airbase that was launched from was hit, but minor damage sustained. So clearly, the Israeli Defense Force is seeing this as a very successful day for their defenses. Nevertheless, it was a long, tense, very, very stressful, sleepless night across Israel. We saw air defenses being deployed above the city of Tel Aviv. And also, just to put this in some kind of historical context, there were rockets and missiles intercepted over the old city of Jerusalem, over the Dome of the Rock, over the Wailing Wall, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Some of the most sacred sites for three of the main religions were at risk yesterday, as was the civilian population of Israel. Luckily, very, very little damage done.
Just thinking, where you are there in Tel Aviv, what is the feeling from those around you?
Well, it's subdued. People are very much staying home, staying indoors, primarily staying close to their bomb shelters. But there is an element of business as usual. You look out, you see some people out and about, you see some people trying to go about their business as well as they can. The problem is you do have to stay close to a bomb shelter because you know that these things can happen again. Now, there is a certain amount of reassurance, but there is mostly anticipation, not because another strike is imminent, but because the Israeli government's response may be decided in the next few hours. And that will be a crucial factor to see if this unprecedented attack by Iran then turns into all-out war in the region.
Yeah, I think everyone looking to see what Israel's retaliation would be. I know you said that announcement's coming up, so you don't know for sure, but is there any thought or feeling as to what it might be?
Well, there's a lot of people trying to find out exactly what it would be, and it's difficult to tell because there is political pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu to respond decisively and harshly and immediately. We've heard from the National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir. He is a far-right minister known to be on the more extreme fringes of Israeli politics. He said it is not the time for a proportionate response. He wants to see a full-blown military response against Iran. Crucially, though, members of the war cabinet, which will ultimately make this decision, Benny Gantz, former defense minister, leading in the polls, a former political rival of Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's not talking about that. He's talking about building a coalition regionally to exact a price from Iran. Now, they still want to exact a price. They still want to get revenge. But first, they want to build a coalition regionally. Now, that is a very different narrative, which could be playing in to what experts are calling strategic patience, trying to find a way to strike back against Iran, but not just immediately hitting back on Iranian soil. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, also saying similar things. The big question, which direction will Prime Minister Netanyahu choose?
And Alex, just obviously this has all gone on, but obviously the situation's still going there in Gaza. What's the latest you can tell us on the ceasefire talks?
Yeah, absolutely. That would have been the leading story today had it not been for this massive attack by Iran. Hamas rejecting the latest proposal tabled by the United States, broadly agreed by Israel. That proposal would have seen 40 Israeli hostages released for 900 Palestinian prisoners, 100 of which are serving life sentences for murdering Israelis. That number of 900 has been increased from 700 by the Israelis in this latest round of negotiations. The other issue was the return of civilians to northern Gaza. The Israelis had previously said, we will only allow 60,000 people to return. They've upped that number to 150,000 in an effort to try and get a deal across the line. Another sticking point on what has previously been the easier part of these negotiations, 40 hostages versus Palestinian prisoners. Very tragically, Hamas say they don't have 40 vulnerable hostages. That's women, injured, and elderly. We know that an 86-year-old is still being held in Gaza, and they do not want to make up that number of 40 by releasing soldiers or men of fighting age. They also want to have the ability to have more of a choice on which Palestinian prisoners are being released. And finally, their absolute red line in these negotiations, they want to see the full withdrawal of Israeli troops. Israel says absolutely not going to happen, so we're deadlocked.
And Alex Cadier is not far away. Thank you very much, sir, from Tel Aviv, Alex Cadier. Yeah, we head towards 6 o'clock. It's been more than 6 months since New Zealand voted in their national-led government, its coalition, and its campaign to get things back on track. But one of their upcoming changes is causing a stir amongst a lot of people, especially commuters. The half-price public transport subsidy will end on the 30th of April, which means that 16 to 24-year-olds will be back to paying full price. It also sees an end to free rides for those aged between 5 and 15. Most travellers will be paying more, but some local councils are finding the funds to keep public transport free or cheap in their cities. Leonard Powell visited the bus stop.
So, like, three transports, a bus and a train, two buses and a train. And then from here, yeah, I take a bus and a train back. It's quite a lot.
16-year-old Jess is no stranger to public transport, travelling 23 kilometres from Mangere into the Auckland CBD 5 days a week.
Usually I'm spending like $25 or like $50.
Each week?
Yep.
Half-price public transport fares were first introduced in March 2022 to woo commuters back onto buses, trains and ferries after COVID-19. The scheme was extended through until July last year in response to the cost of living crisis and has remained in place for 16 to 24-year-olds. That too will disappear from the 1st of May, but Jess says the half-price fares should carry on.
I think that's kind of trash because, like, you know, like elderly people, they get free rides via their, like, gold card and that.
Half-price fares are now a distant memory for 26-year-old Duncan.
I don't know, just like it didn't bother me how much money was coming out each week for like bus fares, but now I kind of like delegate the money now, you know, but it's back to full price. It feels like, I definitely know it's a chunk coming out of my paycheck, you know.
He spends around $50 a week to catch the bus from Onehunga into town. and says it soon mounts up.
It's like $5 either way, which sounds fine until you realise you're spending $10 a day and then you're spending that 5 days a week, and then you try to argue that you're saving money by not getting fuel for a car or anything, but feels like I'm spending an awful lot on it.
He thinks 16 to 24-year-olds are often people who desperately need help financially.
A lot of them don't have good jobs or anything, you know, a lot of them just working part-time or they just go to uni, so that's going to take way more of a sum out of their pay than someone like me that has a full-time job.
While most councils are ending the discounts, some are funding the subsidy themselves. Otago Regional Council will keep fares free for children aged 5 to 12. Further south, Invercargill City Council has extended the subsidies for 2 months while waiting for data to see what difference it's made. Invercargill City Councillor Leslie Soper is keen on keeping it.
So we've got a declining use of public transport. I'm very passionate about public transport being used in that wider context of climate change and, you know, how we can address the whole wider world issues. And it seems to me that we have the ideal opportunity with subsidised fares for young people of getting young people into the habit of seeing public transport as a viable and sensible option to use.
Leslie Soper concedes the patronage for public transport in Invercargill has not been high, but thinks long-term vision is required.
Let's get as many single-use private vehicles off the roads as we can for young people going to school, to work, to sports activities.
Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown recently made headlines when he said that if people didn't want to sit in traffic, they should take a bus. The irony wasn't lost on social media, with some calling it tone-deaf in the wake of the scrapped subsidies and often understaffed services. Back on Queen Street, Shashan has been catching the bus from Blockhouse Bay for 16 years. He thinks anyone who uses public transport should be rewarded.
Well, I think that should be for everyone, because not just under 25 using the transport, but everyone uses it. So there should be some incentives.
One 23-year-old said they'd registered their hop card as a 15-year-old to take advantage of free rides. But come the 1st of May in Auckland, children aged 5 to 15 will pay child fares, as will students aged 16 to 19 with a registered secondary school concession. Tertiary students, community service holders and mobility card holders will still be entitled to a fare reduction. For this 18-year-old uni student, the increased costs had him questioning why not jump in the car instead.
We've got a lot of students that come out to uni from everywhere. Like, my ride is about an hour and a half even. And even the hub, because I've seen the hub prices, they're still pretty spinny, in my opinion. What's the point of public transport? No one's going to be using it anymore. Everyone's just going to be driving to uni now. They're going to have to make more car parks for people that don't want to, you know, waste money weekly on topping up their hub cards and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, that is the case. So it would be interesting to see what happens. Tons of feedback has come in this morning. Thank you very much from this texter. Temapara Clark in the Netball World Cup was sin bin for a few minutes in the final against Australia. I can't remember the year, but we held our breath and we still won. Was that the one that went to extra time so long and I'm just jumping up and down in my lounge going, I don't even know what the overtime rule is, but I'm cheering. That was a gold medal anyway. That was Con Games, I'm thinking. Here's another one. The BYD Seal is more aggressive looking than the new Tesla 3. It will be more popular, similar price, top quality finish and more. That one comes from Murray, who also said it is at the supermarket that the price decrease in vegetables and fruit is noted. You know, those dastardly individuals the Commerce Commission hates. Any praise for them? Any comment that the market is at work? That's Murray. Zane, a couple of points. One, Iran retaliated for the illegal act by Israel on bombing their embassy in Damascus. That act by Israel was an illegal act of war. Two, the Australian Rugby League will be privately seething that the Bondi knife killer was wearing a kangaroo's jersey. There's a, obviously no suggestion of the link between the two. Someone there with the back in the trailer tip. Yes, you always turn the steering wheel the opposite direction to where you want the trailer to go. That's correct, yes. Another one here. Hello to the team. Amazing 22 draw against Manly on the 13th. The weather's improving. Take care. We will. And this is the end of First Up for this morning. We celebrate a happening on this day. Do we celebrate a happening on this day? We remember a happening on this day. What about that? On this day in 1999, this is Tammy Wynette. An argument over her inheritance that she left led to her body being exhumed on this day. Goodness me. Morning Report is next with Ingrid and Corin. From all of us here at First Up, Have yourselves a wonderful day. Stand by your man.